Now, without further ado, let me introduce our second speaker, Dr. Edward Latessa. Dr. Latessa is a professor, and he's a division head of the Division of Criminal Justice at the University of Cincinnati. He's published over 110 papers on criminal justice, corrections, and juvenile justice. He's co-author of 7 books, including Correctional Contacts and Corrections in the Community. Both of these books are so popular that they're in their 3rd edition. He's directed over 100 research projects, including studies of day reporting centers, drug courts, drug programs, halfway houses, intensive supervision programs, and juvenile justice programs. He and his staff have assessed over 450 correctional programs across the country. He's a consultant with the National Institute of Corrections, and he's provided technical assistance and workshops in 40 states. He's been president of the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences, and of course he's received a number of awards from several organizations, including the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, the American Society of Criminology, and the American Correctional Association. Now, this is the second time that Dr. Latessa has been a speaker at the Family Impact Seminars, and I think I could safely say he's one of the best speakers we've had, ever had at a seminar. Now, despite these many impressive accomplishments and his past performance at a seminar, I must admit I hesitated to invite him to come today. And why on earth would you say might I hesitate? Well, the last time he was here was 2003, just after the Badgers whooped the Ohio State Buckeyes on that rainy Saturday night at Camp Randall. Do any of you remember that game as well as I do? Well, I did give him a little razzing about that game, and I'm expecting a little ribbing in return this year, given that the Buckeyes whooped the Badgers this year. So, and I don't have a lot of sports background, but I do know that the best defense is a good offense. So let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Ed Latessa. His topic today is what science says about designing effective prisoner reentry programs.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. I'm going to stand down here, talk to the audience, rather than stand up there. Karen's only given me a half hour, so I'm going to go pretty quickly through this. And when she called and asked if I'd come again, I said, you know, Karen, I've already spoken to the folks in Wisconsin. She said, well, they want to hear you again. So I can only surmise from that you really didn't get it the first time. I'd like to talk. I'm going to cover a lot of this works.
Okay. All right. Is this cutting into my time?
Oh, all right. I have a lot of material to cover, so I'm going to go very quickly since you have it in front of you and talk a little bit about what the research tells us is most effective, and then talk a little bit about policy and what some states are doing around the country in the area of reentry. A number of points I want to summarize. First, I want to talk a little bit about the public's support for rehabilitation. I want to talk about what we call the risk and need principle, who and what we target is important. I want to talk a little bit about programs. As Jeremy alluded, they can be effective, but they're not all equal in terms of their effectiveness. And finally, give some examples from some other states. It's a myth that the public is monolithically punitive. Public opinion poll after public opinion poll shows that the public, in fact, supports rehabilitation. They want people held accountable. The dividing line with public opinion is violent behavior. If you look at the studies, violent offenders, they want them locked up. but other offenders, they're willing to provide programs, they're willing to work with them in the community. The public wants things that work. They're pretty vocal about that. They don't want us being too lenient, and they don't want us doing things that aren't very effective. The support, as you can see, even the emphasis of prison, when asked that question, most in the public say that we ought to be providing rehabilitation. So there's a lot of support out there for it. I think we just have to build on that. Second question I want to address is who and what we target is important. Two principles that have been gleaned from the research. The first is the risk principle, which basically says target higher risk offenders. And by higher risk, we're talking about those individuals that are most likely to fail. Okay. We're not necessarily talking about the seriously violent offender or the felon. You can be a high-risk felon. You can be a low-risk felon. Jeremy talked about the failure rates. Right? So that's a good way to think about it. If two-thirds of the people that come out of prison fail, which group are we worried about? Well, we're worried about the failures, not the ones that are going to make it. And so basically that principle says, put your attention onto those people. Right? The need principle says what you target's important. Not all programs work, because oftentimes we target things, quite frankly, that don't have much to do with criminogenic behavior. Let's talk a little bit about the risk principle, and I want to stress the importance of this. There's a couple different elements to it. One is provide most intensive treatment to higher risk offenders. A simple way to think about it, higher risk offenders have more risk factors. And so when we design unidimensional programs, we don't get much effect. We have to go at criminal behavior in a broader way. And people that have more risk need more treatment. What's that mean? Well, that's a challenge. But this is a study that was done recently looking at a prison population. The researchers gave three dosages of evidence-based treatment, 100 hours, 200 hours, and 300 hours. They wanted to see what effect you got based on dosage. I mean, think about this. You go to the doctor and you have an infection, and they give you a prescription. And sometimes they tell you have to take it all, even if you're feeling better. Take the whole prescription. And the reason they tell you that is because the infection's difficult, and they want to make sure they get it all. Right? If you're like me, you save a few pills for when you're sick again. Right? But that's why they tell you that. What did the researchers find? Important. For moderate risk offenders with few needs, 100 hours of direct treatment was sufficient. But for high risk offenders, that had no effect. For higher risk offenders or multiple need offenders, 200 hours was required. And for the very high risk, high need, 300 hours wasn't enough. Why is this study important? Because oftentimes we put people in good programs, but we don't give them enough treatment. And so the research indicates you could be wasting your time if you're putting higher risk people into a moderate intensity kind of program. The second element of the risk principle basically says when you target lower risk offenders, you often increase recidivism rates. And here's a way to think about it. Can too much treatment be harmful? Too much treatment can kill you. We don't all run down to the hospital and say, give me some radiation therapy. I'm feeling pretty good today. Right? And that's what we find in the research. What meta-analysis tells us, you target high risk, you get an effect. You target low risk, you get a negative effect. We demonstrated this a few years ago in Ohio. We did a study involving 13,000 offenders and 50 residential programs. Most of the programs reduced recidivism for higher risk offenders, but they increased recidivism for lower risk offenders. That's the treatment effect for lower risk. The red bars are where those programs, they actually did worse with low risk offenders. Okay. For high risk offenders, almost all of the programs had a treatment effect. And if you look down at the end, we had programs that reduced recidivism 20 and 30% for high risk offenders. I want to remind you there were 13,000 offenders in this study. So if you can get treatment effects of that magnitude, you can have a pretty serious impact. Ohio doesn't put low-risk offenders in these programs anymore. Okay? By the way, you'll note that we had some programs that didn't work with anyone. They actually increased recidivism at every level. The scientific term for that is shitty program, by the way. But I'm pointing that out because even those programs did better with high risk than with low risk. Next, we have the need principle. Target and assess criminogenic risk factors, an important word. People have lots of needs. They have lots of needs. We have need, medical needs, physical conditioning, anxiety. People have those needs. They're just not correlated with criminal behavior. And so programs that target them don't have much effect. Okay? The more criminogenic risk factors we target, the higher the effects. This is an important finding because it's telling us it's not just targeting a risk factor. You're not high risk because you have a risk factor. You're high risk because you have a bunch of risk factors. Let's take employment. There's a simple one we all understand. Okay? For a probationer and parolee, Bill, for a probationer and parolee in Wisconsin, being unemployed, is that a risk factor? Absolutely. Is it a risk factor for you? You think? If you lost your job, would you all start selling drugs? Would you mug old ladies? Would you rob 7-Elevens? No. What would you do if you lost your job? You go find another job. Being unemployed is not that big of a risk factor for most of us. But if you said things like, I can make more money in a day than you can make in a month. If you said, I'm a 9-to-5 thing isn't for me. I'm not working for $8 an hour. Now, being unemployed dramatically increases your risk because you have 40 hours a week to do nothing but get into trouble. But by itself, being unemployed isn't that big a criminogenic factor. These are the major set. All right, these are the major set, and very quickly we have history of criminal behavior. The earlier you start, the more things you do, the higher the risk. Personality, being adventurous, pleasure-seeking, antisocial cognitions, thinking what you do is okay, not caring about who you hurt, and of course hanging around with the wrong folks, as we all just talked about. We've got family, school, leisure, and substance abuse that round out the major set. But I want to be clear about this, because most of us that study risk factors believe that this set, along with other minor risk factors, run through the big four. These are the big four right here. These are the major set. These are the ones we need to target if we're going to improve employability and reduce substance abuse. We've got to target these. And to illustrate that, I want to show you a study that was just done in Pennsylvania that I think is an important study for reentry, because they looked at people that came out of Pennsylvania and they looked at those that failed and those that succeeded. What distinguished it? Well, of course, the failures were more likely to continue to hang around with people with criminal backgrounds. They were less likely to live with a spouse, less likely to be in a stable, supportive relationship, and less likely to identify someone in their life to serve as a mentor, the kind of social networks that Jeremy talked about. Sometimes that mentor could be the parole officer, by the way. But that was distinguished successes from failures. In terms of employment, they were slightly more likely to have difficulty getting a job, but just slightly. They were less likely to have job stability, less likely to be satisfied with employment, less likely to take low-end jobs and work their way up, more likely to have negative attitudes toward employment and job expectations, less likely to have a bank account. But surprisingly, they were more likely to report they were barely making it, even though the success group reported over double the median debt. That's cognitive. That starts here with our thinking. Pennsylvania said if they had a driver's license, they could get a job. It wasn't about getting a job. It was about working the job and keeping the job and working their way up in the job. Alcohol and drugs was a problem, but there was no difference in prior dependency. What was different is the guys that didn't make it didn't have the coping skills. When they got into stressful situations, they went back and got high. They went out drinking. They fell back into those behavioral patterns. But that's about skills. They had unrealistic expectations about what it would be like. They had poor problem solving and coping skills. They failed to utilize resources. And they were more likely to maintain antisocial attitudes. Surprisingly, they did not differ in their ability to find a job, nor did they report difficulty in finding a place to live. Not that that isn't important. That's very important, finding a place to live. But it didn't distinguish the successes from the failures in this study, which I think is very important. And it mirrors what we know about risk factors. By the way, these are not criminogenic risk factors. I got this from my friends. It's a Christopher Columbus style of program design. When he set out, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he didn't know where he'd been. I want to point out he did it like four times. And he did it on state money. These are not criminogenic. Running teaches inmates the value of success. I thought we didn't want them to run. Here's drum circles, my favorite. I'll read you what they said. They introduced the first drum circle in a New Zealand prison, and they describe it as wow. That's the data they have there, wow. The staff was amazed because most clients continued drumming for 2 hours without stopping to smoke. Right? It doubles as a smoke cessation program. You can kill two birds with one stone. Here's one. Man's sentence was probation in yoga. And here they are. They're doing it right outside the courtroom. You don't even need to have any special space for it. I don't know what these knuckleheads are doing, but they're meditating their way out of criminal behavior. And this one here is a new one. This is my one I like. This is out of Canada. Restorative justice. Dog sledding is restorative justice. And they said exercising wilderness skills was seen as a way of rebuilding the perpetrator's self-esteem. So they're worried about the perpetrator. I think that's great because when they escape from prison someday, they'll be able to make it for a while out there in the wilderness. So this is what we call correctional quackery. You're not going to change criminal behavior through these kind of programs, right? And I've seen virtually every kind. Next point I want to make is not all programs are equal. You want to use evidence-based approaches and make sure your programs are implemented with integrity. There are different forms of evidence. The lowest form is anecdotal. It's what makes us feel the best, though. Right? Everybody, that's what we rely on, that anecdotal evidence. But what we really want to rely on is scientific evidence, results from controlled studies. It doesn't have that warm, fuzzy feeling to it. But it's how we decide when something is actually getting an effect. Right? Strongest effects are behavioral programs. Behavioral programs have some attributes. They focus on current risk factors, not the past. Who you're hanging around with, that's a current risk factor. You're not going to work, that's a current risk factor. Versus what? How your father abandoned you when you were little, or how you got along with your mother. Program after program I go to, they want to do this therapy with offenders. Mm-hmm. You can't change the past. Second, behavioral programs are action-oriented. They try to teach offenders new skills. New ways to behave. What do you do when your friends come over and they want to go out and get high? How do you get out of that? That takes a skill. And we have to practice that. And we have to go over it. We have to come at it from different directions. In terms of behavioral programs, these are the most popular in corrections, starting with structured social learning. Structured social learning where new skills and new behaviors are taught and modeled. Social learning is a very complex process. It is not a complex concept. It's an easy concept to understand. How many of you have children? How many of you turned in your parents when you had children? That's social learning. You woke up one day, you're your mother. That's the last person you were going to be at 15 was your mother. Let me assure you that. I have a 16-year-old. She told me when she's a parent, she's going to let her kids do whatever they want. I said, you go right ahead, Al. You just be home at 10 o'clock. But I've turned into my father. I say things I swore I'd never say. You born in a barn? You think money grows on trees? I'll give you something to cry about. That was always my favorite. I said to my son one day, I said, do I look like Rockefeller? He said, who the hell is Rockefeller, Dad? I said, I'm sorry, do I look like Bill Gates? But that's social learning. And the problem with social learning is we don't just learn good things from people. We learn bad things from people. So that's why we have to structure the social learning in our programs. Okay. Family-based approaches. Okay. Family-based approaches, mostly with juveniles. But family-based approaches overall have shown a 21% reduction in recidivism. Overall average. But a lot of variability. Guess what? If you target high-risk families, if you focus on criminogenic needs, and if you use behavioral approaches, the effects are dramatically higher than if you don't. And, of course, the popular cognitive behavioral approaches, how offenders think and what they think, targeting their thoughts, teaching them new ways, teaching them how to get out of situations. What do we know about COG? The latest study showed average effect a reduction of 25%, but the most effective configurations, 50% reductions. What didn't matter? The setting didn't matter. Didn't matter if you were doing it in prison or when they came out. If you're doing it in prison, though, you had to time it prior to coming out. Juvenile versus adult, minority or females, and brand name of curriculum. Didn't matter. You got the same effects. What did matter? The dosage mattered. At least twice a week increased your effect. Quality assurance mattered. Making sure the program was delivered properly and the staff were trained increased effects. Making sure you got them through it, taking away the barriers to get them through it. targeting high risk, and combining it with other services. That's the need principle. Offenders don't have one risk factor. I got to change your attitudes, but I also have to help you get a job. Those increase, they doubled effects by doing a couple simple things. What doesn't work, I won't spend a lot of time on this because I'm probably running out. Karen hasn't told me yet. I'm good. Oh, I'll tell some jokes then.
Okay.
All right. No. Some things that don't work very well, things like shaming offenders or drug education, trying to educate them about the phenomena, not a very effective technique. And I go to prison after prison, and we're doing drug education with guys that have been using drugs their whole life. I mean, really, it's a dumbass idea when you think about it. Right? But we do it all the time. It's cheap. It's easy. It just doesn't get any effect. Right? Talking cures, self-client-centered approaches, talk therapy. What do you want to talk about tonight? How are you, tell me what's on your mind. Those kind of approaches aren't very effective. Offenders like them because they can deal with everything but their risk factors. They don't have to practice new skills. Vague, unstructured programs. Counseling for everyone. Life skills. What does that mean? Give me five counselors. I'll give you five different approaches. You want structured programs. You want to have a manual. You want to have targets for change. You want to make sure your staff follow it. And, of course, punishing smarter kind of approaches make us feel better. Boot camps and scared straight and those kind of things, but there's no evidence that they work, all right? I was at a boot camp the other day, and I interviewed a young man, and I said, what have you gotten out of the program? And he leaned in my face. He said, I'm in the best physical condition of my life, sir. And I thought, now he can run me down and kick my ass even quicker, all right? So those kind of things, even though they're popular, we like to do them, everybody's done them, you look at the data, it just isn't there. We're not getting any effects from it, all right? Program integrity. And I've been to Wisconsin many times. I've assessed programs around the state. I have a lot of things going for you. But in my opinion, this is where you've really got to put your efforts now. It's in implementation. It's in program integrity. The programs I looked at, they were using evidence-based approaches. They just weren't doing them very well. We've done a number of major studies in the last couple years, and in every study we've done, the higher the program's integrity, the greater the reduction in recidivism. Residential programs, probation programs, community programs, low-quality programs actually increased recidivism. High-quality programs reduced recidivism. That's a 30-point swing there. They all got the same funding. They all got the same offenders. The difference was the quality of the programming. Residential programs, those halfway houses you're funding. We're a big halfway house state in Ohio as well. We fund a lot of halfway house beds. Well, guess what? Some of them actually make offenders worse. But the good ones can get average of 22% reductions. That's a 40% swing. And finally, juveniles. We did a big study 2 years ago looking at juvenile programs. We had programs for low-risk kids and moderate-risk kids and high-risk kids. At every risk level, the higher the quality of the program, the lower the recidivism rate. So integrity makes a big difference. Let's talk a little bit about what some other states are doing. Starting with my home state, Ohio. Ohio has a number of initiatives going on now in the area of reentry. One targets families. The Children of Incarcerated Parents program targets inmates with young children. We've only put it in four largest counties because that's where most of our offenders come from. We're targeting family cohesiveness, employment, criminal behavior, and it starts before they come out. We identify inmates that are going to be out within a year or so, and we start the programming before they come out, and it continues when they leave. All the programming is done by contracts with family agencies and others around the state. Another big problem, and Jeremy alluded to it, is looking at the barriers that exist, the unintended consequences that we have. In Ohio, University of Toledo Law School study found over 400 collateral sanctions for offenders. And you know what happens. You pass laws over the years, and you add things that make sense. And after 20 years, you've got so many statutes and rules no one even knows. Well, law school went through things like that you couldn't be a barber. if you come out of prison, even though they all cut hair in prison, right? They couldn't be a barber. It goes back from the old days when they used to shave people. Now most barbers don't do that. Barriers included employment, civic, and stigmas. And so Reggie Wilkinson, who was our director at the time, convened a committee. The committee included legislators and professionals in the field, and they have crafted some legislation to try to remove some of these barriers. Not all of them. Some of the barriers make sense. We don't want sex offenders working in schools. But things like, you know, barriers that where people can't live or people can't support their families, we have to remove them. And so we have three major areas. One, expanding reentry courts, addressing collateral sanctions. For example, the department is going to issue certificates of good conduct for inmates that have done well in prison and met all their conditions. This is a certificate they can give to an employer to say, I've done everything that's been asked of me. Take a chance and hire me. And so they're looking at these kind of things and enhancing agency operations. Pennsylvania, following the study Pennsylvania did, they began to look closer at reentry, enhancing employability and job readiness, promoting families and interpersonal relationships, because those were two big findings in their studies, and addressing the adjustment period between incarceration and the community. Many inmates in Pennsylvania go into transitional settings before they come out, and you do much of that too with halfway houses and so forth. They've created new positions, reentry specialists, reentry coordinators, healthcare release coordinators. They've created new tools, checklists, and a hard-to-place list and resource guides to be used around the state. And they've created new programs, both inside and outside the walls, new programs designed to address specifically those cognitions and those skill deficiencies that inmates had that they found in their study. And, of course, they're promoting reentry courts. Oregon... I've done a lot of work in Oregon over the years. I just want to mention one thing that Oregon's done that no other state has done thus far, is they have they passed legislation a few years ago requiring evidence-based programming. Their approach was to tie it to the dollars. It started at 25%. It went to 50, and with this biennium, it'll go to 75%. So they require that 75% of their programming dollars used by Department of Corrections, the Youth Oregon Youth Authority, mental health, and substance abuse go to evidence-based programs. What it's done in Oregon is it's forced them to take a hard look at the programs they offer. And they've had to come up with processes to evaluate their programs. And they've put the onus on providers to demonstrate that they're using evidence-based programs. And so when you go to Oregon today, that's what they talk about in the field. How do we do evidence-based programs? And I'm not saying that they're there, that all their programs are great, but it's changed their thinking about what they do with offenders. And finally, North Dakota. I picked North Dakota because North Dakota has the lowest incarceration rate in the country, or very close to it. Them in Minnesota are always fighting it out. It's one of eight states to participate in a transition from prison to community program sponsored by the National Institute of Corrections. They are targeting recidivism by focusing on evidence-based programs and targeting specific risk and need. They're not trying to do everything for everybody. They're focusing on those factors that are most likely to contribute to failure. And they have created a transitional accountability plan. They have revocation guidelines to try to rein in the use of prison as a revocation. I mean, think about it. We have a guy in prison. Right? He gets out of prison. He fails. And what's the first thing we do? We send him back for a short time. Right? Like that's going to fix him. Didn't fix them the first time. I'm not sure why we think it's going to fix them the second time. What we've got to do is have the programming available. In Ohio, by the way, we found that sending parolees to a halfway house at every risk level that were violators reduced recidivism, on average 12%. So rather than process them back through our prisons, we sent them to a halfway house where they could get programming, get their feet back on the ground, get a job. Now, we're talking technical violations here, but I think that's important to think about that in terms of policy. And, of course, they formed reentry teams, people in the community, people in the institution that are their job is to aid reentry coming back to prison. The lessons, who you put in the program is important. Right? Pay attention to risk. Not all offenders need programs. Some come out of prison, and they've got places to live, and they've got jobs, and they've got families that care about them, and their risk is relatively low. We don't have to spend a lot of time or money on them. Right? What you target's important. Stay focused on the big four. I can talk more about that when we have questions, but I really think that we have the smorgasbord approach. We throw all these programs at offenders without really getting at the fundamental risk factors, their attitudes, their associates, their impulsive behavior, their lack of good skills. And using behavioral approaches is the best approach. Assessment is critical. It's the engine. But you have to have integrity to your programs. You have to make sure your staff are trained, are delivering the program well. If you don't, you can have an evidence-based approach that will actually get negative effects. We have some research that shows that. So with that, I'll finish. I got 2 minutes to spare, so I'll take extra questions. How's that?
Do we have questions for Dr. Latessa? Representative Sherman.
Thank you. I live in Indian country, and I have for 35 years. Mm-hmm. Three reservations in my legislative mm-hmm. district. They are characterized by the same sorts of problems that are typical of mm-hmm. any minority population or mm-hmm. most minority populations. Mm-hmm. Family dysfunction, high levels of alcohol, drug abuse, mm-hmm. and lots of crime. Mm-hmm. However, in the last 25 years, there have been major changes in Indian country that I think are unique. Mm-hmm. The rise of sovereignty, the rise of the exercise of sovereignty, has meant that there are a lot of middle-class jobs on reservations that didn't exist 25 years ago. Gaming revenue has meant that there are a lot of mm-hmm. entry-level jobs available that weren't in existence 25 years ago. There's been a rebirth of interest in traditional culture and language and a tremendous focus on dealing with alcoholism. I wonder if anybody has studied what effect that has had on crime rates and recidivism in Indian country, or you know, if we're missing an opportunity to look at a laboratory situation, basically mm-hmm. an isolated group of people who are going through tremendously positive social change on many levels.
Well, that's a good question. I don't do that particular work. I do know folks that do look at crime rates in communities. And tends to be more macro criminology. I have no doubt that those social forces you've described are changing those communities. And I think if we want to go into communities and make them healthier, we could learn something from those examples. The work that I do really focuses on, you know, what do we do with the offender sitting across the table from us? You know, how do I, you know, someone who has gotten in trouble, someone who has gone to prison, someone who has gotten put on probation, what do we do now to reduce their risk? Okay? And so it's a very current focused kind of approach. But if we want to reduce crime rates, if we want to reduce poverty, if we want to reduce the health problems associated with it, then we have to change communities. And what you've described is obviously a success story in doing that. I would be surprised if there hadn't been, you know, some studies looking at those kind of things. But again, it's just not my area to do it. But I think it's a lesson for other communities that are, don't have the human capital and don't have the success to take a look at how this very poor traditionally group with very high rates of crime, and alcoholism has improved.
In my community, there's an effort to involve the local district attorney, the police chief, social service agencies, the federal prosecutors, whatever, in teams that sit down with violent offenders when they come back to the community. Can you talk about the effectiveness of those kinds of efforts where, you know, it's sort of a version of scared straight. Here's what's going to happen to you. We're watching you now that you're back in the community. It is a way for the community to say, we realize you're back here. We want you to live here. Here's the social service agencies that are available and all that. But here's what we're going to do to you if you fail. Mm-hmm. Any research on that kind of thing?
That approach actually is pioneered by one of Jeremy's faculty members, a fellow named Kennedy, who did the similar kind of project in Boston. In Cincinnati, we're doing a similar approach, and my faculty members have been involved in that. And so what they try to do is identify those people they think, the higher risk kind of folks, bring them in. It's a two-tiered approach. Scare them, right, which, by the way, probably doesn't work very well. And then hook them up with programs and services. Interesting, when Cincinnati just started the process, when they first brought folks together, they got 129 calls in the first 24 hours from folks saying, can you help me? I need help. And then what Cincinnati realized was, what do we do now? Because they had these social service agencies, but many of them weren't prepared to deliver the kind of programming that I've described. In fact, I did a workshop for them last week to talk about how to redesign some of their programs. So I think that there's some pluses there. You've got everybody involved, the prosecutor, the chief of police, the social service agencies, corrections, and that's important because they're speaking with one voice. But I also say this, if they don't have the programming to help those folks, just threatening them, just getting tough with them again, probably isn't going to get us what we want. We've been doing that for 20 years, and you know all it's led to is 700,000 people coming out of prison, many of them going back again. The question becomes, the problem with you know, prison, you know, locking people up, and there are people who need to be locked up, but as Jeremy said, they all get out. It's that there's this old story about the family in going through the Virginia, driving through Virginia in the fall, and they're looking at the leaves change, and they see this big sign, and it says, Dr. Smith, veterinarian and taxidermist. And they think that's kind of a funny combination. And they get up closer, it says, either way, you get your dog back. Right? And that's really reentry. The problem is we can threaten offenders. We can lock them up. But they're going to come out again. And so how do we, A, try to keep them from going to prison, and B, if they do, how do we see they come out and come out better than they went in and hopefully can be successful? So I think the efforts there, what I would advise you is that those efforts, now they need to make sure that they've identified the offenders, or do they have the programs and services that can really help them get jobs, be successful, reunite them with their families. If you do that, I think you'll get some effect from that kind of program. But it's two halves, and if they just do one to the exclusion of the other, they won't get very far.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. A few years ago when Wisconsin had its budget crunch, one of the things that we did to the corrections budget is we cut out the researchers who look at these programs, and we also reduced the number of people in the prisons who are working on rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. Two-part question, was that a phenomenon across the country, and then how do we, you know, turn the tide on that thing? Because what you said, I think, was very important, but it's just that we now don't have the people in place to evaluate the programs that we're doing or that we're looking at implementing, and then we just sort of spend money on whatever anecdotal information we get.
Yeah. Let me say this. First of all, most studies show having programs evaluated increases effectiveness. The research all shows it. Because if you're evaluating a program, you have data. and someone's coming in, and you know, I don't know if you know, but California is in real trouble in corrections. They've been in trouble for years, and the youth authority is just been in shambles, and now they're putting all the kids back in the streets. And a number of years ago, I talked to their old director. In their heyday, the California Youth Authority was the model. It's where everybody went to see how they did it. And I was talking to their old director from many years ago, and there's an old researcher named Ted Palmer. And Ted's kind of a legend in correctional treatment. The guy, and he's still alive. He's in his 80s. And the director told me whenever they were making a decision about new programs or what they want to do with kids, Ted was always in the room. And after whoever was made their pitch, they turned to Ted and said, "Should we be doing this, Ted?" And he said, it saved us from going down all these paths with all these crazy ideas. Ted was always there to evaluate the programs and tell us if they were working or not. So I don't think that's I think that's a small investment with a big payout. In terms of cutting back programs, I think it's been a combination of things around the country. I think we've cut some programs, but part of it's just been the increase in offenders. I mean, if you're going to take in more offenders and your pot doesn't grow, you're going to serve less people. And so in many states, they still have the programs that were out there, but now instead of 20 or 30 or 40% of offenders getting through those programs, they got 10% of offenders going through those programs. But if you're going to, you know, and you always have to make choices. No matter how many dollars you throw, you're still going to make some choices. Who do we put in a program? What do we do? And I think we have to let the research guide us, because it's clearly saying not everybody needs to be in an intensive program. But some people, if we're not going to put them in the right program with the right dosage, we're not going to get any effect, which is just like saying you're wasting your money. Right? Let's put them in programs that get the right dosage and the right in the right treatment, and at least we can get some effect. But what we've seen across the country, it's probably similar to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.